Hey, this is Andrew. Thanks for tuning in to Doth Protest. This episode you're about to listen to is actually, it's a little bit different from former episodes because it's edited from a couple different pieces. When James and I originally sat down and recorded this, I started not feeling well in the middle of our conversation, and I just told him, you know, can we pick up again at another time to record the rest of this? So I just went ahead and came back by myself and recorded the rest. So apologies, you won't see James on part of the episode because of that. And I just went ahead because it's been a hiatus. It's been a little while since we've had an episode published on the podcast. So I just really wanted just to get this published and to put it up because we do have a couple more episodes that we're going to be publishing in the next month. And so I just wanted to get this out there. So I apologize for listeners if it's the continuity or the smoothness isn't quite there, if it sounds kind of patchy. But I do think y'all will enjoy the episode. The first 20 minutes, this wasn't really foreseen. The first, I think it's the first 15, 20 minutes, James actually talks a lot about his sabbatical and reflects on that and some of the things he did during his sabbatical, which is part of a larger project he's looking at regarding... I guess church growth, if you will, though that, you know, it's not, maybe it's kind of, you know, kind of an overused phrase, but you know, that's, you know, stuff he researched and traveled and did some interesting things during his sabbatical for a couple months that he had, or I think it was a couple months, but he'll share about that. And so the first kind of third of the episode is on that, but then the rest of it is actually, as you'll see in the title, we decided to revisit our list of favorite theologians. Our listeners will remember in 2022, we did a series on, we did a top five, like if, you know, if we had to pick a top five favorite theologians who have impacted us the most, whose work resonated with us for whatever reason. You know, we did that, but, you know, I found myself in the recent weeks, months, looking back on that series and thinking, you know, I that was definitely, as we emphasized in this episode, you know, that was a snapshot of, you know, where I was then, where I was as in my theological formation, in my, you know, life. And looking back, there'd be some changes I would make. And so that's what I share in this episode. And James doesn't really have the changes like I did, but he still goes back and he reflects on that list of theologians, people he put on his list back on that series. And so just hope you enjoy this episode for what it is, and God bless, and take care. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Doth Protest, a podcast on Reformation history and theology. Drew and James are joining you today. This is Drew speaking. And just a reminder to give us a rating if you listen to us through a streaming platform like, you know, Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anything that lets you rate us. Go ahead and give us that and any comments or feedback if it allows you to as well, so we can hear your thoughts on the podcast. But James and I are doing a show today about 2 years ago, we did a series on our favorite theologians, and we each picked our top five. And I'd realized that was 2 years ago, and I had some thoughts. I was having some reflection back on those episodes and the people I named and the reasons why I gave it, and get or had the people that I did at the time. And, you know, the first kind of version of an episode I did like this, James, this is before you were even in the picture. It was with, Isaac Rayburk. Gosh, am I blanking on his last name? From Miserable. Yeah. And we did it was more so from him, like top five theologians of Anglicanism and why. Mm-hmm. And, not that we're always into countdowns on here,
and doing lists, but it's a way of, at least speaking for me, it was a way to pay tribute. And I think for you, James, this is pretty much very true as well, to pay tribute to people who have been formative for us and who we are as people, first and foremost, and then who you know perhaps have influenced us pastorally or in our ministry or in our life in the church as well. So that's so you know I think there's lots of value to doing these lists because it can be kind of fun. But anyways, James and I decided to do this episode to revisit that, and so you know I didn't really have anything else to put out, but maybe just dive right in. I guess it's worth mentioning, James, this is the first episode you've been back from sabbatical.
That's right. Yeah.
So vacation's over. Though I
Yeah.
guess it wasn't a vacation. You sabbaticals involve a type of not project, I don't want to call that, but something that you're going to do while you're on sabbatical that will grow, that you will, you know, help you grow in ministry. And the point of sabbatical, from what I take, is to give you the space and time to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And also
And
have rest. Sabbaticals relate, you know, Sabbath is that's it's related to, you know, that term in some way, I'm sure. So
Yeah, I mean, the standard fare for a sabbatical is that when you go on sabbatical, your primary purpose is to take a break from being in your congregation, but also to, as you're being, refreshed, as it were, to do some sort of study or project or whatever you want to call it, that, like I said, this is standard fare. It's not necessarily required, but something that you could bring back to the parish that could benefit the parish. And so I did some personal study. I also did some stuff that could hopefully benefit my congregation. And yeah, it's good to be back. Good to be back in church on Sunday. And the building was still there. My rector is very capable, so I knew that would be the case at least. But people clearly missed me and were glad that I was back, and that was humbling and wonderful.
And a little bit about your studies you were doing. You were looking at different churches' methods of hospitality, from what I'm one in, and then also what's the you know the having a consistent message that comes from their pulpit.
Yeah, so the overarching theme was, since COVID, churches have been declining significantly, just across the board. And so, I see some churches in the Diocese of Virginia where I am, some churches in the ACNA, some other church Episcopal churches around the country that are growing exponentially, and I wanted to see what they were doing that, fostered that and encouraged that, recognizing always that it's not we who cause the growth, but God who causes the growth, a la 1 Corinthians 3. So I met with 8 different clergy from all over the country, from a rural church here in Virginia to the largest Episcopal church in the country, and talked to all of the clergy, and they all said variations of the same thing, that the reasons why their churches are growing, according to them, is that they are keeping Sunday the primary focus of their life together. That includes doing substantial like looking over what you're doing on a Sunday and trying to make sure that what is coming across there is a unified message. The music and the sermon and the liturgy does it in and of itself are proclaiming the gospel. And by gospel, of course, the unfortunate problem is that when I say gospel, many different things come to mind for different people, but what gospel really is the good news of God in Christ for you. And so having that
making sure that the music is accessible enough, that it's not, completely esoteric. Not everything is in Latin or German, but it's singable, that kind of thing. The second subheading was hospitality and how important it is that churches and clergy are engaged with their people in really radical hospitality, caring for them and loving them and going out of your way to show them devotion, and especially newcomers as well. When you have a newcomer, getting in touch with them fairly soon after they come, most clergy I talked to said between 48 hours and 1 week, and inviting them out. And a number of those instances where the clergy were talking about that, they said that the people that they have invited to coffee or lunch tend to say, "This is the first time a pastor has done this for me." And it's those little things that tend to add up, and it's those things that encourage people to come and stay, because really what you're doing with proclaiming the gospel every week and having that be your central focus of your existence as your life together, and engaging in hospitality, what you're doing is you're teaching the people that God loves them first, foremost, and primarily, but that you love them too. And that is something that really encourages folks to stay. And then the third thing was to have size appropriate programming for children and youth. And it doesn't mean like, always go to the trampoline park or whatever. What that means is making sure that you meet the needs of the people who are there first. And then hopefully, as you're meeting those needs on a regular basis and more people are starting to come in, the program can grow. And what's essential for that, what everybody has said is essential for that, is to have the right person in the position as youth leader. A warm body won't do. It's someone who has a passion for and a calling to youth ministry that's got to be in that position. Otherwise, it'll peter out.
Everyone, I sense so much anxiety in church life that, you know, around youth, like they're like they have to do something youth like right now. And it's like, well, it's not like you need the right person first off, or else it's like you might as well not even do it at all. you know, having been in, done having done youth ministry for, you know, full time for several years.
Well, the last thing I'll say is that the theological framework for this was just as important as what I actually learned, which is when people talk about church growth, they tend to talk about it from a very law-heavy, legalistic perspective. Like, here are the five things that you need to do for your church to grow, and if you do them, then your church will grow. It's almost like a prosperity gospel type thing. But the problem is that that's just not true.
Yeah, you'll do all five and it may or may not.
Right. And so the way that I'm going to explain it to my congregation when I have a chance to talk to them this summer about it is, look, we could do all of these things and do them well, and the church may not grow. But all things being equal, these are the best practices for encouraging church growth. I wanted to take it from a law gospel perspective, from a realistic perspective, recognizing that it's ultimately God is the one who draws people to himself. God is the one who, through his word and sacrament, brings people into the life of the church. We are there to live together and be in community together. And we can encourage some of that, but ultimately God is the one doing the work. So that's kind of was my overarching mentality about this.
I planted the seed, God gave the growth.
Right. Yeah.
So, on to our revision of our list. I don't know, James, you want to go first? You're remind us who your top five were, and would you make any changes and why? And because basically when going back to that episode that I first did with Isaac way back, where we first did kind of a top five, and this is from Isaac's point, this is his, from his standpoint, who he felt were the most influential theologians for him. He also said, this is a snapshot, right? And then when we did our series, we're like, this is a snapshot. This is, where I am right now in my ministry, who I felt, and especially a lot of times it's more recent people that have been, that you've really read a lot from, that have inspired you and influenced you. And so, this is a snapshot of 2022 for you and I, and tell us who are on your list, why, and if you'd make changes.
So back in 2022, my list was Martin Luther, Bo Yeats, the Swedish Lutheran bishop, C.S. Lewis, Michael Horton, and Gerhard Fertig. And on the whole, I would say that all of those are still very influential. But that certainly was a snapshot. I haven't read anything by Michael Horton in a little while. Doesn't mean that he's any less important to me, but I just haven't read anything by him in a while. I've done a lot of reading of C.S. Lewis in January and February. I read, let's see, Mere Christianity, The Great Divorce, The Abolition of Man, The Magician's Nephew, and I think that might be it. That's enough.
Yeah, it is quite a, a couple of years. That's a lot more Lewis than I've read in the past couple of years. So.
And I still love C.S. Lewis. Reading Mere Christianity for the first time helped me to really begin to own my identity as an evangelical Anglican. Because I just saw in him such a profound love for the Lord and also a profound love for apologetics, which
You're talking about mere
because
Christianity?
mere Christianity, but Lewis's perspective in general. He was deeply in love with apologetics, especially telling the story of the Christian faith in ways that it will actually reach people. I just finished Alistair McGrath's book, Narrative Apologetics, and C.S. Lewis is a major focus of that book. Because if
What
you
does
think about
McGrath mean by narrative apologetics?
so instead of like presuppositional apologetics, teaching people with propositional statements, or using reason to prove creation or things like that. What McGrath is talking about is the way that the Christian faith spread was through the telling of the story, the telling of the story of Christ's life, death, resurrection, and ascension.
Because it moves you.
McGrath, I think, rightfully also helps people focus on, like, I'm not saying everything about Puritan culture and afterward is great, but the idea of the testimony is a form of narrative apologetics where you are telling about how God has been clearly actively at work in your life, that kind of thing. That's a way in which the faith can be shared and spread. Obviously, there's trappings that come with that, that can be problematic. Kind of like, if your heart isn't strangely warmed, then you're not a Christian kind of thing, which is deeply troubling. But back to Lewis, there is so much about him that I love. I think Lewis probably erred on the side of being an Arminian. And so that I
As
find that
opposed to a
Calvinist. As opposed to Reformed or even Lutheran would be on the opposite end of that. The belief in the bound will as opposed to the free will.
Mm-hmm. Lewis would say you would take stock in our agency to choose or reject Jesus, you know.
Yeah. And I think
that for him that would make sense on a certain level, because he spent, as you're talking about apologetics, he's spending so much of his I don't want to say career, but just like his calling, he felt as a newfound Christian, you know, Christian author, to tell people, to give people the goods, and you know, to like, look, you can accept this, right? So right. Maybe that ties into his an Armenian, more Armenian understanding. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Yeah. And so the other thing that I quibble with, although it's not enough for me to remove him from the list, is Lewis was a classicist, and so he was very deeply he had imbibed very deeply of the classics of philosophy, and I think he was a bit more of a Christian Platonist than I am. A great example, I was talking with Drew about this the other day, in The Great Divorce, when the people travel from hell up to heaven, when they're standing in the light of heaven, the people who are from hell are basically incorporeal. They don't have form. And when they walk on the grass of heaven, it hurts their feet like they're walking on nails. And when they see people who belong in heaven, in effect, they are really real. You know, people who are in hell are a shadow, a type, but not the real thing, but they can become the real thing when they go to heaven. That's the kind of dichotomizing that Plato does. And I don't know that I quite buy that. Although, that being said, that's not the ultimate point of The Great Divorce. So
yeah, you've never read The Great Divorce. I've heard the critique of C.S. Lewis being an over Platonizer. Now, I mean, someone could make that critique of Christianity in general. I mean, there is so much, the influence of Greek metaphysical categories is just undeniable when we trace the, especially the developments of the creeds and the language used to discuss God, especially on the metaphysical realm, does bear the influence of largely, you know, Plato, and, you know, St. Augustine, you know, went from, Manichaeism to Christianity through Plato. More so, Platonism was kind of like the middle, it's kind of the intermediary between him, you know, it got him thinking along certain lines, where he saw, well, actually what Christianity offers is the solution to the problem that Platonism presents. And it's the real solution to the solution that Platonism basically started to hint at, which is, you know, how do I ascend to be with God, right?
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, Platonism, you know, but yeah, for Lewis, I've definitely, you know, Paul Hinlicky has made that critique of Lewis. It was on the Queen of the Sciences podcast, you know, which we've talked about on here, and, you know, Paul Hinlicky was a recent guest, but I think he really did not like the four loves, because he felt it was like Platonism on steroids. I think he might have used that term to describe it. I like the four loves because it seems, while I've never, you know, I've never taken a huge interest in like the different Greek words for love, and, you know, trying to, you know, catch the differences between them. Yeah. What that book says about the nature of human friendship, and especially like male friendship versus what romantic love is, I just thought it was so I was like, wow, these are things that I always felt or thought about, but I never put into words. And here he's wonderfully describing how these things do feel to humans. And so, you know, I enjoyed that. But yeah, no. So Lewis is still on your list, though. These less than desirable aspects of his writing and thought have not persuaded you to take him off.
No, I think he's always going to be on my list because when I was questioning my faith in high school, through the ministrations of my brother, who had by that point already started to drift away from Christianity, a friend of the family gave me a copy of Mere Christianity, and when I read it, I was enthralled by Lewis's arguments and by how clear and I know some people don't like his trilemma, for instance, in Mere Christianity, that Christ is either liar, lunatic, or Lord. You know, Richard Dawkins said, well, there's a fourth option, he was just mistaken. But I think the stakes are a little too high for him to have just been mistaken. I really do think those are basically your three options. Either he knowingly was not the Son of God and said he was, he was not the Son of God and he thought he was, or he is the Son of God as he said he is. And I think that's something that I kind of held on to when I was in the midst of that questioning, things like that. So Lewis is still on the list, and I've done a fair amount of reading from him recently and have not been convinced otherwise, which is good.
That's cool.
Was that?
So that's good.
Yeah.
I read, speaking of, while we're on the topic of Lewis, I did recently read, I haven't really read any Lewis since that episode we would have done, of course, but I did read The Question of God by Dr. Armand Nicolai Jr.
Okay.
It's The Question of God, C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud Debate God, Love, Sex, and Meaning of Life, which I, from what I understand, they just turned into a film where I think Anthony Hopkins plays Lewis again, because he played Lewis back in the 90s. They did it.
No, I think Anthony Hopkins plays Freud.
Oh, he's Freud in this one? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't see the movie, but I read the book, and the book is the book was not what I thought it would be. I thought it would be a make-believe dialogue between the two, but it's more so this author's exposition of both of them, and putting those expositions in, you know, showing the contrast between the two. And I just don't think there could be as often as they were concerned with the same questions of life. They of course arrived to very different worldviews, I suppose, but there was, and in fact, when I preached the Ash Wednesday sermon at church, I took I mentioned a little bit about this, how, you know, Lewis, you know, how he was such an uplifting voice for many during the Second World War.
Right.
And that's even more moving when you know his background as a veteran from the First World War.
Right.
And how, you know, for many years, his memories from the First World War haunted him, and he saw, you know, war as the just the epitome of all of every kind of human fear, you know, isolation, abandonment, being away from those you love, pain and death. You know, it's the epitome of every single human fear, but kind of wrapped into one. But
right.
But that was kind of his outlook when he's an atheist. When he became a person of faith, yeah, he didn't say like, oh, war is great now or anything, but he, you know, when the Second World War came, now him as a Christian person, you know, found that, there's lots of wisdom in recognizing our mortality and facing it and being, that leads to an honesty with ourselves. And so, and that was kind of in the chapter where the author talks about Freud and Lewis is how they view death. So it was a really interesting read. It was the only, thing on or about Lewis that I would have read since, but
So the other theologian that I would add, I don't know if who I would take off or if I would take off anybody, but I would add this one. I actually had the pleasure of interviewing on this podcast last year, or maybe it was late 2022. I don't remember. Justin Holcomb, now Bishop of the Diocese of Central Florida.
Yeah, he's become a bishop since you had him, since you had him on. I couldn't make that
Yeah.
up. Regretfully.
Well, we're just gonna have to invite him back, I guess. But
He's
yeah.
a bishop now. He's too good for, I'm just kidding. I'll edit that part.
But I read a little book that he wrote, and by little I mean it's around 100 pages, called On the Grace of God, in January, and it was just beautiful, it's not like what he was saying was groundbreaking. It's not like he was giving a new perspective on grace. In point of fact, he was conveying the very message of grace that God conveys in Scripture through throughout the Scriptures, but especially through people like Saint Paul. And it was so clear and so concise that when someone wants to look at the topic of grace from any level of education, just about, I'm going to recommend this little book to them because it was very, very good.
What's the title? What's the title of that?
On the Grace of God.
Okay.
And if memory serves, it's a volume in a series. I don't remember the name of the series offhand, but I should be able to find it easily enough.
Well, we brought him on to talk about the Heretics book. I remember that. Even
Yes.
though I wasn't there, but yes, that was the
Right. And he is, of course, very well spoken and very well read in more than one subject. This is On the Grace of God is a book in a series called A Book You'll Actually Read.
But you have a list of six now because you didn't want to remove your original five, so.
Yeah, it's tough.
You're not going to take Luther off? I'm kidding.
This is not funny.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, no, of course Luther stays. I would probably I'd probably say goodbye to Michael Horton, which is tough because Justin Holcomb and Michael Horton are very good friends. And I don't know that either one would be happy being replaced by the other, or replacing the other, as it were. Maybe Justin's not going to listen to this, and I won't have to worry about it.
I'm sure they are understanding people and have tougher skin than you think. So I
I'm sure they
wouldn't.
have exceedingly tough skin. I no
Especially
question
to
about
be
it.
a bishop, you have to have tough skin to be that.
That's true. That's true.
My list of top five has changed because my list was going from I don't know if you ranked your list, James, but I remember I went like when we began the series, I started with like number five and went down went and no, I didn't. No, I didn't. I think we went chronological. Either way, my list of top five was Martin Luther, of course, Augustine of Hippo, and Augustine. I guess, potato, potato, and Athanasius, the early church father. Then I had Paul Althaus and Karl Barth. And Both the latter two have fallen off my.
Hey, this is Drew again. Just picking up where we left off. What you just listened to was the last of the first recording, the first part of this episode. Before I wasn't feeling well, so here I am, just returning by myself to resume where I left off. As you would have last heard, two of the people from my original top five list, top five theologians list, have fallen off. That's right, Paul Althaus and Karl Barth. I guess I could start with why Karl Barth, and to be clear, Paul Althaus and Karl Barth are both theologians whom I still, in many ways, greatly respect. Starting with Paul Althaus, he was he is still such a standard as far as reading modern interpreters of Luther. As far as a 20th century interpreter of Luther, he is one of the go-tos. His two main works that have been translated into English, which I would have mentioned on the original series, was The Ethics of Martin Luther and The Theology of Martin Luther. To this day, they are still used in pretty much any type of coursework where you're being introduced to the thought and life of Martin Luther. Again, those two books, Ethics of Martin Luther, Theology of Martin Luther, are both so to this day they hold up so well. Althaus was really just was able to understand Luther completely in all his nuances and everything, and to distill it and to write it in very accessible language. Of course, originally in German, but the English translations are also even more accessible, I would say. Most of Althaus's work is in German outside of those two works. And a lot of my doctoral research, as I think I've mentioned throughout on the podcast, is on a certain aspect of Althaus's thought and life. But it also touches on World War II and Hitler and the church's complicity during that time and the German scene during that time. And interestingly, Althaus's appropriation of Schleiermacher's theology for his backing of Hitler, which is probably what he's most infamously known for in the Anglophone world. If you're not a Lutheran person who, or someone who studied Luther and maybe read those two books I mentioned, all doubts outside of those two works. Which is a good thing he's known for. He's basically known as this German theologian in the 20th century who, in the early 30s, gave support for the rise of Adolf Hitler. Very easy, of course, and completely understandable, especially from our, hindsight today, to not consider that his best moment. But I'll revisit that later as to why I removed Althaus off the list. It wasn't solely for that. We all know that stuff about Althaus, but I re removed him off the list for things related to that and then some other reasons. But he's no longer on my top five, and neither is Barth. And I guess I'll start with that, and because I'll start now with Barth and talking about why he fell off my list, and that is connected with someone who is now going on my list. So the person going on my list is Wolfhart Pannenberg. And this wasn't without some hesitation because there are facets of Pannenberg's work that I don't like, and that's okay. I don't think the point of having this top five list was to have the theologians who are perfect in every respect. Even though many of us maybe have that one or two people we really think of that of, but I don't think Pannenberg's perfect as a theologian. But I'll give you my reasons why he's going on. God is the creator and Lord of the universe. And, classical Christian doctrine would use this word to describe this aspect, this aspect of God's nature as omnipresent. God is involved and present in all things, and including that includes how he is involved and present in the course of events of our world. So, in other words, history. Wolfhart Pannenberg, on one end, he was a big influence on a wave of people you may have heard of, some popular apologists or and evangelical scholars who have rose up in the world in the last 25 years, one being William Lane Craig, who would go on to be a well-known apologist, who argued for the veracity of things like the resurrection and the Christ event as a historical event. That is all tied to Pannenberg's influence. Pannenberg had really held to this idea of God as involved with history. And this is where Pannenberg actually parts ways with his teacher, Karl Barth. So just to give you kind of a brief little overview, early bio of Pannenberg, he was he's a theologian who studied under Karl Barth. He also studied under the church historian von Campenhausen, and also Gerhard von Rad in the Old Testament scholar. And so he's a mid-20th century German theologian of the generation after Barth, Tillich, and Bultmann. And Pannenberg's just come up in my life in the past few months in interesting ways. I wrote an article for Living Church back, this would have been in, when was this? I guess in the fall. It was a few weeks after the death of a Lutheran theologian, Karl Broughton. And I'll put a link to the show notes in it because I'm not going to read the whole thing outright. But I found myself revisiting the theologian Karl Broughton, who I read from a lot, in kind of the last year of seminary. Just someone whose books I stumbled upon. And, you know, I hadn't really visited him since. But when I heard that he died, you know, I was like, I want to write something. I want to tribute. We want to give a tribute to this guy. You know, I haven't really done that. I don't have a lot of published things out there. But Living Church, I want to give a big thanks to. They published this for me. And I'll put a link in the show notes. But it was when I was revisiting Broughton's work that I didn't realize he had all these footnotes to Wolfhart Pannenberg, the theologian I've been talking about. And I was found it very interesting. Pannenberg is one of those names I always heard. And I took a seminar about 2 years ago now. I took a seminar on the systematic theology of Pannenberg, his actual systematic work, which is two volumes long. Just knowing Pannenberg as a name, and maybe you've read him reference here or there. But 2 years ago, I took a seminar about Pannenberg and Pannenberg's theology under my doctoral supervisor, Paul Hinlicky. It was the first class I actually had with Dr. Hinlicky. And I remember when I first started the class, I wasn't keen on Pannenberg because he was very critical of Barth for reasons I didn't quite fully understand, but then over time came to understand why. And Pannenberg's just kind of shown up ever since in different, you know, and he, like, for instance, when I went to write this tribute on Karl Broughton, Pannenberg showed up. And this is where Pannenberg showed up, I'll just say, when I was doing that, and I unexpected came across, you know, encountered the great Pannenberg again. So Karl Broughton, in the early 60s, emphasized or witnessed, as a young theologian scholar himself, Karl Broughton witnessed firsthand, and I'm just going to quote from the article I wrote, the ascendancy, quote, the ascendancy of a new breed of theologians and Bible scholars who emphasized a new premise, the relationship that faith and history have. For Broughton and others, this also meant that there is a relationship between the Jesus of history, the Jesus of faith. Broughton found a way out of Barth and Bultmann through the work of Wolfhart Pannenberg. Pannenberg did not reject historical criticism, but in fact saw how this method can actually affirm the plausibility of the historicity of the Christian claims about Jesus. From Pannenberg, Broughton learned that there is an important link between the messianic consciousness of the pre-Easter Jesus and the post-Easter community's confession of him as Messiah. So, unquote. And I encourage you to go read the rest of what I wrote, just so there's a little more context there, if there was anything confusing about that. But, you know, I mentioned how there was a wave of, like, apologists and evangelical Christians in North America, who some may be household names, like William Lane Craig, William Lane Craig studied under Pannenberg. Pannenberg's whole emphasis of The relationship of faith and history wasn't based on a type of triumphalist apologist. I mean, he would not have seen himself as a Christian apologist, at least first and foremost, he wouldn't have. He wasn't on a quest so much to prove Christianity, but rather he, through an honest inquiry of what do we mean by revelation, first off, the concept of God revealing, what do we mean by the, you know, the concept of truth, and what do we mean by the kind, by really honing in and being precise on what these things are, he rather would say we arrive to the truth of Christianity. Like I said, he was not some type of biblicist or inerrantist. There would be theological conservatives who would take some issue, some major issue with him on quite a few things. But where I do find the value in him is that he sees that faith and reason do not have to be enemies. I do think sometimes his weakness lies in here too. But I'll get into that in a second, too. But for basically, and I'm going to quote a short little bio written of Wolfhart Pannenberg the author's name is Don H. Olive. Basically, I'll just quote this, quote, closely aligned with the concept of a universal science is the insertion of faith into the public arena. Since theology is a public affair, faith cannot be allowed to retreat into a private world of personal experience. It cannot be a special way of knowing, immune to the open demands of human rationality. To make faith such is to fragment truth into that which is true according to faith and that which is true according to reason. Faith becomes the way of knowing the truth of private revelation. Science becomes the means in the public truth of nature, history, and philosophy. But such a scheme denies the oneness of truth, and for Pannenberg raises grave questions concerning this concept. Pannenberg affirms that, quote within a quote, for too long a time faith has been misunderstood to be subjectivity's fortress into which Christianity would retreat from the attacks of scientific knowledge, unquote. This retreat into pious subjectivity can only lead in today's world to be the destruction of any consciousness of the truth of Christian faith. What he was getting at here was that it goes back to this idea that he believes God is involved with history, right? God isn't, he would see as almost like Gnostic this sense that a lot you see in a lot of pious Christianity, in many forms of pious Christianity all throughout the history of the church, that revelation is something that is almost outside of history in the sense that it's outside of quote-unquote normal experience, and that it's just something that is just granted by God and his radical self-disclosure. Now, the thing is, Karl Barth, that is where Pannenberg kind of parts ways with Barth. So Barth was a teacher and early influence on Pannenberg. But for Barth, Barth's major early theological insight, which I think is captured brilliantly in his commentary of the Romans, and really is the thesis of that writing, is that God is ultimately at odds with the wills and desires of humanity. Kind of like the cliche, God's time is not our time. And that's not really a cliche so much. There's biblical language of, you know, our thoughts are not, you know, God's thoughts, you know, we are, there's a whole otherness of us and our creator in terms of how, what we comprehend. But the reason why Barth emphasized this radical way that we're at odds, that humanity's wills and desires are at odds with God's, is that Barth was writing at a time where he saw the ultimate hubris of humanity, at least in his world, with the outbreak of World War I. He saw the arrogance of Germany And he was Swiss. Bart was Swiss. Bart lived and learned in Germany. His entire formation as a young theologian was in Germany. And but he saw, you know, something akin to the idolatrous generations who forsake God and worship their Baals and their Babels. And, you know, he saw a modern day kind of equivalent to that with 20th, early 20th century Germany. He saw a country that worshipped their own perceived might and technological ability, and their, you know, and their minds. I mean, Germany of the time of Bart, we're talking the 19th, 20th century, you know, Bart was a product of the Theological Academy. He saw just the brilliance of this, the culture of high intellect that Germany had. And, but through this, he said, you know, they succumbed to the danger, or they fell into this perception that man can be its own God. So this was Bart's concern, and Bart writes, you know, a lot about history, about the topic of history in his commentary, the Romans, and that this would, and this would basically be a conviction of his throughout his career, that, you know, humanity lives and cares so much about its own sphere of things. Humanity can easily mistake its finitude for divinity. Bart wanted to basically drop a bomb on all this and, you know, and to emphasize how God is beyond and sovereign over all these things. He's so otherworldly, and that we must remember, in that we must remember our lowly place before God. But we forget God's ultimate supremacy over history, and so therefore we make our own history. Bart would use the terms of history and so-called history, who really live on a different plane from God, cannot fathom the course of God's history. And we live in our own so-called history, which is really at total disjunction from God. But this is where, with Bart, comes the Christ event. In the Christ event, Bart sees God breaking through into our so-called history in the event of his self-revelation and his self-disclosure in Jesus Christ. And Bart writes about this very dramatically, like a God intruding upon, you know, arrogant human presumptions. And, you know, in many ways, Bart's reformed Calvinism comes through in many ways. You know, the finite can't contain the infinite. But, you know, I think something we can value from Bart, I know, I'm supposed to be talking about Pannenberg, but I'm talking about Bart still, and how, you know, what I think is things we can value about him, is that he sees the theological project of 19th century theological liberalism as violating that, you know, kind of reformed axiom of the finite can't contain the infinite, because 19th century liberalism just saw Jesus as the most ideal human, rather than like the God-man incarnate, which is something that is wholly other from the aspirations of a fallen humanity. Rather, Jesus is the most ideal human that we humans can aspire to be like, but that forgets that we're a fallen humanity, and what we aspire to be like is ultimately flawed, and we can't mistake what we think is the ultimate best ideal thing for a human to do as something God would do, because we're not God. And so Bart extends that to see even religiosity and churchiness as a violation of, you know, the finite can't contain the infinite axiom, and is quick to take on the, and because he sees religiosity and churchiness as quick to take on the mantle of something that cannot be contained. And so spiritual reality for Bart, for one, reality is, it's very real, but yet it can only be understood in the spirit. And while I think that is very true in a sense, there's plenty of precedent, biblically speaking, the eyes of faith that Paul speaks of, the distinction between setting our minds on divine things as opposed to human things that Jesus speaks of. You know, Bart kind of takes this insight over in a way, and attaches to it his rather radical disinterest in history, because he sees history and historical study as the enterprise of a fallen humanity. But that's different from Pannenberg, as I've just sort of pointed out. Pannenberg basically sees revelation not as this perhaps radical inbreaking of self-disclosure, but rather he sees revelation as the knowledge of God that we gain through God's indirect it's knowledge we gain indirectly from God acting in history. You know, because basically, you know, and he learns this from his early mentors, Pannenberg does, from von Rad, from Campenhausen. Basically, the data we have, whether it's the authors of the scripture, the early dogmaticians of the church, the data we have that have formed this great and wide tradition, traditional belief system known as Christianity, is based on data that has been put to writing by people based on experiences that people have had with God. I'll share another quote from that book by Don Olive on that short bio of Pannenberg. It says, quote, "Pannenberg regards the indirectness of revelation as the sure result of the investigation made into the concept of revelation in ancient Israel and primitive Christianity. In both ancient Israel and primitive Christianity, it was the historical activity of God that revealed God's deity and power. This historical activity could either be an event or a complexity of events, but in each case it was still the events themselves that revealed God's deity and brought about belief. Even so eminent a theophany, a visible manifestation of God, as the person of Jesus, did not reveal God as did historical events. God made his glory only indirectly visible in the fate rather than in the person of Jesus. Thus, the self-revelation of God was and is an indirect presentation of himself by means of his historical acts. This understanding is of crucial importance and has far-reaching ramifications for Christian theology." I want to read the next paragraph he has, that Aleph writes, because it's very important. "Not least of these ramifications for Christian theology is the fact that if revelation is indirect, it follows that the comprehension of revelation must come at the end of the revealing history. Only after the completion of God's revealing history is his deity fully perceived. Thus, revelation cannot be involved with single revelatory events. Revelation comes about through the series of occurrences which themselves continually revise the content of revelation until the completion of history, when God's deity will be in full view." Unquote. So basically, Pannenberg here is accounting for the eschaton. He's accounting for the fact that if you read, you know, I know James spoke earlier about narrative apologetics. If you read theology narratively, chronologically, from the Bible, from the earliest writings of the Old Testament into the New Testament, you do see a progression of sorts. You do see how God, of course, acts in history with the people of Israel, how the understanding of who God is and what he is doing is progressively known. People don't start out and to this day still don't have this full comprehension of what God is up to. But the scripture reveals, especially through the culmination of the Christ event, how God is continually fulfilling that big picture that we cannot see. So I think that's a really, and of course, and I don't have time to get into it, Pannenberg is kind of influenced by the philosophical category of history unfolding that Hegel has. And Pannenberg kind of has that framework he finds that as helpful in ways that are way too deep for me to get into. You know, but it's in a way, it's Pannenberg is honestly saying that, you know, scripture is, for the most part, yes, there's poetry, there are all kinds of genres of literature in there, but for the most part, it is an unfolding of events purported to take place in history. He wouldn't even say they all took place in history. He does not reject historical criticism and the things that historical criticism may call into question about actually happening. Rather, he sees that the emphasis of God acting in history is so important, almost the chief thing scripture concerns itself with. So taking a page from that insight, he says our outlook as Christians should be to see that our faith is based upon data collected from, of course, the Christians who have come before us, who have recorded these for us, recorded these great ways that, you know, God's deity and power has been revealed in, you know, quote unquote, indirect revelation. I don't know. I would think some things like the parting of the Red Sea and whatnot and things are, you know, pretty direct. Those are pretty extraordinary, and the healings and powers that Jesus has played and everything. So, but all that is to say that Pannenberg, I appreciate him because he takes an interest in history that some of his, you know, the theologians of his past generation who were the big, you know, the big time theologians that came right before him, like Bart Bultmann and Tillich, all did not appreciate to the extent that Pannenberg did. In fact, Bart Bultmann especially were very indifferent toward the relationship of faith and history because they saw the downside of some of that with some of the you know, ways that 19th century and early 20th century, you know, speculative, imaginative writers would try to reconstruct, you know, historical Jesus, quote unquote, who Jesus really was, you know, apart from what you may read in the Bible about him. You know, so we can take a historical interest in bad directions, or just, you know, I would say historically irresponsible directions. So that's why a big reason I like Pannenberg, but he's just shown up again and again in things I've revisited. For instance, I revisited a book called Inhabiting Unity, which I would have read quite a bit from, but don't seem to remember Pannenberg wrote a chapter in that. This book, Inhabiting Unity, was about the Episcopal Lutheran Concordat, which became called the Common Mission. This was the big ecumenical agreement, which, you know, put ELCA and the Episcopal Church in full fellowship with each other, in full communion with each other, as it says. I took an interest in that topic of the Episcopal Lutheran, you know, when I was in seminary, because my seminary was, you know, kind of a byproduct of of those efforts, because I went to an Episcopal / Lutheran joint seminary situation, which I've mentioned in the past, but I had no idea Pannenberg contributed to this book when they were consulting all these theologians to comment about, you know, this agreement the Episcopalians and the Lutherans in the U.S. were coming to, are there problems with it? What is your theological commentary on it? Well, Pannenberg was one of the people asked, and he said this interestingly. Pannenberg says the Concordat, which this was the precursor to the Call to Common Mission, he says the Concordat requires the Episcopal Church to at least invite Lutheran bishops to the ordination of its own bishops. This invitation will commission these Lutheran bishops to discern whether the Episcopal candidate for the office of bishop will, in faithfulness, witness to, promote, and safeguard the unity and apostolicity of the Church. Referencing section 3 of Concordat. Further, these Lutheran bishops are expressly authorized to guide their discernment by the unaltered Augsburg Confession and Luther's Small Catechism, referencing section 2 of the Concordat. This means that the future leadership of the Episcopal Church will be held to a confessional standard that has a real concrete presence. Further, the Lutheran confessions are mandated as a part of seminary training for Episcopal ordinance. One might expect, then, that these confessional documents might put some backbone into the education and selection of candidates for the priesthood. Unlike the ever-shifting sands of Episcopal appeals to the hoary three-legged stool of scripture, tradition, and reason, or vague allusions to the Book of Common Prayer, the confessional resources of the ELCA are far more explicit, inescapable, and useful as a standard for the ordained ministry, especially that ministry charged with oversight, the office of the bishop. I'll end the quote there. So I want to break this down a little bit. I really enjoyed Pannenberg's commentary there, and there's a reason I did and a reason I don't. So I don't think Pannenberg is arguing that, the, you know, and I certainly wouldn't, that, well, you know, the Episcopal Church needs to be more Lutheran. And if you go back to this agreement the Episcopal Church and Lutheran Church were coming to, that could be a great outcome of it. I'm not necessarily arguing that, but I do think Pannenberg brings up a good point here, that the Episcopal Church in its current state and for in recent modern history has not been keen, a lot of it, it's been not, they a lot of the Episcopal Church has not been keen on the idea of having like a confessional standard to profess to. If we go in the back of the prayer book to the 39 articles, we find an example of one. You could say it's, people could argue that it's dated, that it's too 16th century, that the language needs to be updated, whatever, but at least that is what it offers. If we you know, James and I have gone into on the show before, and if, you know, we don't have that grounding in what we believe, then there's just lots, there can be confusion, there can be, I've seen it where people can be confused, like, what does the Episcopal Church believe about this or that? And you're like, well, I, you know, whether it's a matter of practice or belief that they have a question about, you're kind of, a lot of times you can't give them a straight answer because different, there's been different clergy practices. There's been different, you know, and the thing is there needs to be diversity of how we worship, how we do certain things in the church. There's lots of secondary issues that are not nearly, that are not, you know, the way we do them are not essential to who we are as Anglicans. But there are things that are essential, and those I think are summed up well in the 39 articles, as well as the creeds of the church, which I think most Episcopalians would say, yes, we do confess to those. But as far as the articles, they've kind of been relegated to second place. People don't really think about them. In other parts of the Anglican Communion, they're not thought about really either. But for instance, I would say that's an example of what I think Pannenberg's getting at here, that is there is an importance of having something that is more precise than, I love how we even brought up this vague notion of a three-legged stool, which is so problematic, and we've gotten into it on past episodes. I won't even go into it, but so it's not that I'm saying that the Episcopal Church should have adopted Lutheran confessions, though, you know, in fairness, we did, in that agreement, we did make the ELC had conceded a lot more to the Episcopal Church than perhaps we did to them. So, but it is to say that, you know, Pannenberg's critique here, I think, is really getting to something important. You know, Anglicans, there has been that, much discussed topic of what is Anglican identity. And part of the confusion around what is Anglican identity is that we have drifted in some ways from any notion or feeling of necessity to have something concretely spelling out what we believe. And I think we have examples where we did have that, like with the 39 articles. And there's a certain breed of Anglicans who would say that is what we point to, that is our confession of faith. But a lot don't, because of in the last, especially in the last century or a little more, because of different developments that have happened. But yeah, that's a whole nother complicated thing. But I did appreciate what Pannenberg said there. And like I said, his influence on people ranging from Karl Broughton to William Lane Craig to, I just find him a very fascinating theologian. He was a very ecumenical theologian, especially between Lutherans and Roman Catholics. Studied under some great minds. So yeah, he's got all the goods and the impressive resume and the prolific authorship of so much, but basically his commitment to reason and precision, and not in a cold, sterile intellectual way, but in a way that really sees the greater world as something made by God, and who sees all the things that go on in this world, and human ingenuity and human invention, and as all things that were created by God, as all falling within the domain of God and his creation, and all the different fields of study and disciplines from science to the arts is all, you know, part of God's greater world. So he had this openness, I think, to just that, you know. He didn't like he wasn't a big fan of religion becoming compartmentalized, And so, you know, my only quibble with Pannenberg is that sometimes is that I do think faith and reason, while not having to be opposed to each other, are still not exactly the same thing. And there are, we do need to maintain the mysterious aspect of, I don't want to call it an aspect, but the point is that God is ultimately mystery, and he would say that too, you know, because we're still awaiting the full, you know, the full revelation, I guess you'd say, or he would say. But you know, there, you know, Paul does speak of, you know, when even, well, I'll go back to Jesus and Peter, when Peter declares Jesus as Lord, Jesus says, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven has revealed this to you, right? That could be seen as, you know, God revealed this ahistorically. This is not, you know, I mean, obviously historically through Jesus, but also like, but Jesus says, you know, mere flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, right? There is a faith that falls outside of the finite, that has that faith, that trust in something greater than what you see in front of you, is at work here. So, you know, I do think there's something to be said about that. And I'll need to wrap up here. The next person, I'll keep it very short, that I've decided to put on my list. So Bart and Althaus both fell off. Althaus, I guess I'm running out of time too to really get into the details of why he fell off. But basically, he had a very, as much as a great interpreter of Luther as Althaus was, and I mentioned this a short while ago, he was really that. But he also had problematic aspects, as we all do. None of us are perfect. But the things, as I've done further reading on him and had to understand, you know, his theological work, from, you know, especially in the 20s and 30s, I've really come across a lot of his theology of, the orders of creation, and how he understands, so some of Althaus's, not his interpretation of Luther, but some of his wider systematic work that he's done on God and some of his systematic theology. Althaus talks a lot about, you know, the God of creation, and he talks about, you know, the different estates that God has designed into his creation, the estate of the family, the estate of worldly governance, things that actually he does take, Althaus does have, is influenced by Luther in that. But Althaus also talks about this concept of the folk, V-O-L-K, it's a German word. Really just literally just means people, but it also, in 19th and early 20th century Germany, through, because of different societal developments, sociological developments, you could say, which we don't have time to get into, took on a layer of meaning a certain type of people. And by the time of Althaus, there is this sociological idea, especially in Germany, of folk, of, you know, there's people that are, I want to say different ethnic groups, but I'm not quite there, but it's this idea of people, well, I guess you could say of certain racial, biological descent, certain people of certain ancestry that comprise a people as apart from another kind of people who have a different makeup. And part of this is cultural too. But it was basically this idea came up when Germans, you know, Aryan Germans, you could say, were having tensions with Jewish Germans. And so that's when, and this is also the time of Nietzsche, appropriations of Darwin, that would, you know, like social Darwinism, all of this is going on. This is in the air at the time, which is lending itself to, of course, ultimately into, you know, this racial ideology that Hitler and the Nazis held. Althaus doesn't exactly hold to that, but he does have this idea that God created different kinds of people, even, you know, and even before the fall, which can account for the sin in the world and, you know, people's tribalisms and people's hostility toward one another, and groups of people's hostility toward other groups, like racism, that can be accounted for by sin in the fall. But Althaus would say that even pre-fall, even primordially, there is a God created different peoples and intended there to be different peoples who have different vocations, even who have different, rather, you know, and that just flies so much in the face of, first off, what I think the gospel preaches, which is trans-ethnic, trans-racial. It goes beyond those types of lines and boundaries, and is meant to unite all people. And so, you know, Althaus just writes too much and has too much focused on that and goes out of his way, I think. And I think he develops a lot of that theology based on, you know, we're all influenced by our history and our place in history. We're influenced by our culture, yes, but it's just too, it's something that I just can't, you know, I just, there's, it's too problematic. And even if I were around then, I would think it's problematic. And I mean, we spoke about Karl Barth earlier. Barth had a big debate with Althaus over a number of things. But one thing I would say, Barth, you know, is that he rejected the, you know, any type of thinking that would begin to lend itself to, you know, Hitler and the cult of Führertum. So, you know, so Althaus falls off my list. And as I said, Barth falls off my list, even though I like both for good reasons. And then I'll say, before I wrap up, be very quick, you know, I still have to put another person on. I would say, after some thought and reflection, I would say J.I. Packer. We'll probably, you know, I'll keep this very short, and maybe in the future we'll do an episode about Packer or bring someone on to talk about Packer. But J.I. Packer was a evangelical Anglican, to simply put it. You know, I'm not too well versed on his biography, his life, but I have read just some great things from him in over the past year or two, and I realize how important of an Anglican voice he is, and how really he's really more, at least in the US, he's probably more appreciated and liked in the kind of evangelical Protestant world. There's probably non-denominational Baptist people who read more Packer than the Episcopalians, but his books are especially, I think, so important. He writes a catechism called To Be a Christian, in Anglican Catechism. He wrote this for the ACNA, used this really more than the Episcopal Church, unless some Episcopalians just on their own use this, but this was officially used more by the ACNA. But it really just captures what Anglicans believe classically and what they how those beliefs pertain to today. Packer wrote a book called The 39 Articles, Their Place and Use Today. He wrote this, co-wrote this with R.T. Beckwith. He really captures how, you know, we Anglican lost something with its kind of, you know, neglect of the article, or its de-emphasis of the articles, 39 articles, and with the replacement of their older prayer books. You know, he laments how, or Packer laments how, you know, our liturgy, you know, doesn't express the drama and glory, he says, of the sinner's justification by faith alone. That was something that Anglicanism at its best and classically and for many years really just held in its beliefs, you could read, in its liturgy, in its worship. That was the constant message, was the saving, the justification by faith and the saving of sinners, which is the heart of the gospel. And Packer, you know, a lot of his efforts were to remind his fellow Anglicans of this and to keep that at the center. And so I have a huge respect for him for that. He was kind of a, you know, he writes a lot about Anglican history. He wrote a lot about, he had an interest in like Puritans historically, which I don't really share that so much with him, but he did. He's also popularly known as the English translator of the popular English edition of Luther's Bondage of the Will. You know, that's, again, I'd recommend if anyone's going to read Bondage of the Will, I'd read J.I. Packer's edition. And he also, I've used this just for some preaching, J.I. Packer's book, Keeping the Ten Commandments. And, you know, I have used that for some of my preaching whenever the Decalogue has kind of come up in the liturgy or in the sermon or in, the worship of the church. I think that's a great book to go off as well. The former rector before the former rector before me, the parish I serve, was an English-born Episcopal priest raised in the Church of England from the old evangelical scene, Peter Cook. My little tribute to him in saying this is that I have inherited some of Peter's books on J.I. Packer that I haven't even gotten to reading yet. Those other ones I mentioned were ones I already had, but so I have more to read from Packer. So many thanks to the Cook family for letting me have Peter's old books. And J.I. Packer was just a very godly person, very stood on his convictions, stood by his convictions, but also I think was pastoral. He was a world-class scholar, but always doing things accessibly. He was one of those scholars for the church type situation, so or type of theologian. And so I give God thanks for J.I. Packer, and I apologize James isn't here. We could both talk about how great Packer is. And so, but anyways, looking forward to our next episode after this, where James will be back with me. Maybe if he wants to, he'll share some thoughts he had on what I said about Pannenberg and Packer and what I said about Barton Althaus, even though they've now fell off the list. So, but yeah, God bless y'all, and we will look forward to having you tune in again. Sorry for kind of the longness and awkwardness and patchiness of this episode. It didn't turn out exactly how I wanted it to, but we love that y'all love listening to this show, and hope you can get something out of it. God bless and take care.